Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
This to a lot of people. What percentage of the population do you think we need to get turned our way in order to start making some real change in the culture?
Can I ask you to elaborate on turned our way?
More liberty-minded, more thinking outside the box, more thinking outside the system. People who are willing to go out there and not make any excuses in their own life, but realize all the roadblocks that are around them to try to avoid and start talking about them to, start talking like we do. We go out there, we put ourselves out there for ridicule, just try to get people to think a certain way so that it improves our situation.
Right. Well, I think it's a very small percentage if it's the right people. The mission on my website is achieving individual liberty through self-knowledge, self-teaching, and self-mastery or self-development. I think self-mastery might be a little lofty sounding, right? But it's not like become a libertarian and then go online, or become a libertarian and then go to a rally, or become a libertarian and vote for a guy. It's about building a personal foundation that makes it look like you have an attractive life from which liberty is a conclusion. To in as many areas of life as possible, you have to live freely first. Demonstrate what living freely looks like. Are you capable of teaching yourself? How well do you know yourself? How thoroughly are you able to answer the question, why am I really attracted to these ideas? I came to this, over 10 years ago. I wasn't attracted to liberty for healthy reasons. I wanted to shame the shit out of people and be intellectually superior. And I had been a liberal before that, and I thought that worked great for a lot of years until, I heard the guys on Free Talk Live do it, until I heard Stefan Molyneux do it, and I said, this is cool. This is a much better set of shame tools than what I had before. None of that was healthy. That was all about unaddressed defects in me that, unfortunately, I had to address them all while I was doing this show. So the ideas of liberty as a political or a philosophical thing, it has to be a conclusion that has underneath it a foundation of personal liberty that is about, can I teach myself? Can I master myself? And I think that even starts with the foundation of knowing yourself, knowing your motivations, knowing the things that might have screwed you up or traumatized you, and confronting those things and feeling comfortable in your own being before you try to tell or suggest to other people what a desirable way to think or feel or live is. So there's a lot of things that I think need to be in place for a person before they start trying to project these ideas. And I learned that the hard way. There were a lot of places in my life where I could have been more shored up, financially, emotionally, as far as my ideas were concerned, before I ever put a microphone in front of myself and started talking into it like I knew everything. So that's what I try to do now. That's what School Sucks has evolved into. We're trying to give people the foundation so they can actually be effective advocates for what I believe could offer humanity the brightest future, but it's only built up from individuals who are already doing it.
Today, institutions fundamental to the British system of government are under attack. The public schools, House of Lords, the Church of England, even our magnificent police force are no longer safe from those who would undermine our society. And it's about time we said enough is enough and saw a return to the traditional British values of discipline, obedience, morality, and freedom.
everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is February 22nd. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as promised. I rolled in here Friday evening. The city, what the travel agent doesn't tell you, this city floods. There's like three rivers that surround the city of Pittsburgh, and things were pretty ugly this weekend. I know some of you are probably saying, like, Brett, all you've done is talk about how great you thought Pittsburgh was, and then you get back there and you're all upset because some of your car is underwater. Not at all. It was invigorating. I understand that floods can be scary, but it was nothing like that. It was just causing like some traffic problems. But even the traffic here is delightful. Most of my city driving was done in Boston. And people get in their cars, and this is where they take out all of their aggression. In Pittsburgh, oh, what's wrong, buddy? You're not in the right lane? Well, go ahead in front of me. And then everybody waves at each other. It's just, what a welcome. It has been a very productive vacation so far. And we're actually going to be doing a School Sucks meetup tentatively scheduled for next Thursday. If you're not on Facebook, but you are here and you listen to the show, send me an email and I will relay the details to you. I'm going to say it. Pittsburgh is kind of like the San Francisco experience on a budget. Maybe not even really on a budget, just like not expensive to the point where you are offended. In San Francisco, it's like, welcome to the hotel. Thank you for choosing us. In addition to your room charge, there's also going to be a $50 city fee. The city uses it to shovel up people's BMs that they leave on the street. And of course, on top of the city fee, there's also a 25% city fee tax. No one says that here. And it's not like this place is tax-free, but it offers a lot of the same features. The cityscape is just absolutely beautiful. The topography around the city, these impossible landscapes where there's all these residential areas, these beautiful old homes. And because this is in the Rust Belt, if you go onto the outskirts, I can also get my fill of abandoned America. I really like to find old, abandoned, worn down things. I'm going to be posting some of this stuff on Instagram in the near future. It's very, very cool to see what the industry here left behind. Culture is great. You know, there's this area called the Strip District where I've been spending a bunch of time. All of these nice markets where there's fancy fishes laid out on ice and they're all just staring at you. And I have great friends here too. So it's been a wonderful time. And I'm sorry I didn't get a original show out this week. I had a guest cancel. I'm very excited about the guests I have coming up next week. Derek McGill from Praxis is going to be on the show. And I got another one in the works. I'm not going to tell you about yet, but he's a big deal. And that should be along in early March. So thank you for bearing with me as I travel and work on a few things behind the scenes. In fact, I wanted to tell you about one of them because it might involve you. Right now, I'm looking for someone to fill a position, which will start out as volunteer work. But then if it goes well, there could be some compensation down the road. You would be working with me virtually, but intimately, on an ongoing website project. You don't need any website experience. It might be like 5 to 7 hours a week. An hour or two of those 5 to 7, you would actually be spending with me, learning about what's going on here behind the scenes. And the criteria, you love this show, you've gotten a lot of value out of this show, and you are comfortable with the writing process. If this is something that is interesting to you, email me, brett@schoolsucksproject.com, and we can discuss. And I know like finding the right person is going to take some time, so I will attach some urgency to this. I really want to get started on this ASAP. And this is just one thing peeking out from behind the scenes right now, but I'm really, really excited about this. I think it could be a lot of fun with the right person. So if you feel like that is you and you have that time and you're interested in working closely with me, please reach out and we'll see what happens, okay? The show you're going to hear today is a repost of an interview that I did on Saturday for a new libertarian podcast, Rapidly on the Ascent. It is called Free Man Beyond the Wall with Mance Rayder. Not his real name. That's a character from Game of Thrones. So this was a big show, and I cut a lot of stuff out of it because it's repetitive, like my backstory, the history of public school. And I just aimed to create some highlights of the conversation, mostly things that have not been discussed on the show before. It was our first time ever speaking. I thought we had a really great conversation, and I definitely look forward to working more with Mance in the future if the opportunity presents itself. There's definitely a lot of stuff that we could discuss. So I know I didn't go into great detail about what's happening behind the scenes, but I'm very excited. I'm very happy to be in Pittsburgh. I'm having a fantastic time here, and more news will be coming soon. Here are some selections from my conversation on Free Man Beyond the Wall. Thanks for listening, and take care.
I spent 8 years in public school,
mm-hmm.
and I was your typical clock watcher. I was never looking at the board. The clock was always above the board, so I was looking at the clock. It always looked like I was looking at the board, so I never really got in much trouble for that. But I was daydreaming the whole time.
Amen. Yep.
Yeah. I never got the idea when I was in there that I was being prepared for anything. I don't, maybe it was just me. I just never felt, even when I was in high school, and I went to Catholic school for high school. My parents wanted me to go to private school, so Catholic school was a little less expensive than private schools.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard people say, "Oh, I could feel the indoctrination. I could feel this. I could feel that." I guess I've always been a quote unquote and so rebel because I never. All I felt like I was there was to just get to the end, was to just get that diploma. And by the time I was 16, I went to my dad and I said, this is horrible. This is torture to me. Let me just drop out now, get a GED and let me start working. I don't care where I work. I don't care what I can do. I mean, I already had a part-time job at that point, but I said, let me just leave. And my dad was so, you know, It was really weird because I had absolutely no use for school, nothing. And my dad was like, school's everything. You know, one of my eighth grade teachers, you know, wrote in my eighth grade yearbook about how I was going to be onto Harvard counselor. And I'm like, where did you get the idea that, first of all, I would be a lawyer? And second of all, that I would ever go to Harvard, you know, especially considering I barely wanted to finish high school. It was like there were teachers who were pointing me in a direction, but I never felt like I was being prepared for that direction. I mean, I just zombied my way through K through 12.
I think I did as far as like having any sense of self. And I think a lot of people have a very similar story. What I realized in retrospect, because zombieing your way through it is exactly how I would describe it, right? Like I couldn't connect it to a bigger picture. I knew I was supposed to go to college. I mean, I had conversations with my dad where I was like, you know, I don't think I want to do more school right after high school. And he said, you know, you have that choice, but I'll tell you, like, you're going to go out there, you're going to get a job after you graduate, paying you $10 an hour. You're going to think you're rich. And you're going to find yourself, it's going to be hard to pull yourself out of a pattern. You know, like you should, you know, while you're young and while you're fresh, you should just take this all the way to, you know, getting a college degree because that's where the real opportunity begins. I don't think he knew any better. This was, you know, over 20 years ago that he was giving me that advice. What I've realized about my time in school, all they wanted to do was put stuff into me, right? They just wanted, I was just an empty bucket to be filled with meaningless crap that I didn't need to self-actualize, to be fulfilled, to even be successful. You know, I spent 15,000 hours. I mean, not counting the times that I ditched or stole, you know, notes from the office and signed myself out of school, which was a good portion of my senior year in high school.
I
was supposed to be there.
I did
that
in my sophomore year.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah, you were ahead of me. I was like, oh my God, all I have to do is learn a couple signatures and grab a packet of these, slips. And I did that a lot my senior year, but, I was supposed to be there for 15,000 hours. I walked away from that experience between, you know, 1983 and 1995 with maybe 70, 80, 90 hours, instructional hours of skills, you know, reading, writing, basic math that would be usable beyond that in real life. All the teachers tried to do was fill me up with stuff that I didn't want to be filled with, right? And I didn't want that. I wanted to put stuff out. So I went through this period where I would sit in class and I would design golf courses, you know, like things that would have like utility and enjoyment for other people. I went through this period where I did like these elaborate architectural drawings, of baseball stadiums and buildings and cities. Like once I learned how to do like 3-point perspective drawing, I designed cars. You know, this was like around the time where I was getting my license and, you know, I would go to these like European car dealerships and I was learning about cars. So I always just wanted to create or put something out, and that was stifled by the fact that all these other authorities were just trying to jam stuff in. You know, I would do like skits and variety shows. Like I wanted to be a creator. I wanted to be a producer. And school, aside from the newspaper, which I did freshman through senior year in high school, there was and really, really loved that. It was like the highlight of high school for me. There was no way to create. There was no way to produce, because it almost felt like outside of that experience, like nobody cares what you think, kid. You know, contrast that to today with YouTube, where you have kids who haven't even graduated from high school yet, and they've got 100,000, 200,000, maybe a million people watching every thought that they have. It's an amazing transformation that's taken place since that time. But I just felt useless and kind of trapped and suffocated by that experience, because I wanted to project something into the world, even if it was just like fantasy, right? Like I'm not really submitting architectural drawings to like the Boston Red Sox or the New York Mets to build a new stadium. And none of these cars are ever going to get built, and none of these golf courses are ever going to get built. But I just wanted to have the satisfaction of creating something, and nobody cared. And I had very few outlets to do that.
See, I had no idea what I wanted to do at all when I was in high school. I had one idea. I wanted to make money.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That was like the only thing. It's like I got a part-time job when I was 14, and the part-time job actually paid really well. So I was making part-time money that was on par with some of the adults in the neighborhood. And, you know, I mean, very part-time, but pretty damn good payday. Doing what I was doing. I was working at Yankee Stadium, actually. I was vending at Yankee Stadium.
Oh, cool.
And
cool.
Yeah. And by the time I turned 16, then I could work all the games. I could work night games too. So by the time I was 16, I was, you know, for 6 months out of the year, I was pulling in some pretty good money, especially for the time and especially for my age. So I immediately was like, all right, I don't care about this. So I ended up graduating high school and decided I want to go to college, and I thought about engineering, and I definitely want to do some writing. And I'm like, well, the great thing about this is I'm going to do what I want to do. Now I get a chance to go to school because I want to go to school. So the first class every week in my schedule was, you know, ENC 1101 English writing. Mm-hmm. And 6 weeks into it, I was done with college.
And what happened in 6 weeks?
To me, it was just the same exact thing as high school. It was like, yes, I wanted to learn this stuff, but I realized that the teacher, I can't even remember her name. I'm not going to mention her name, but she was an idiot. She was, I could tell that I was smarter than her, and by any metric, and maybe not in what she was teaching, but I quickly picked it up, and I quickly realized I could learn this I could just take the text and learn it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't need to be sitting here, and I don't need to be giving them money in order to do this. I don't need to be wasting my time. So even once I got to college, and then, you know, I did a couple years, and then another few years went by, and I was like, okay, I want to go back to school for this subject because it's a subject that I've really become to love. And, you know, I've really come to love, and boom, I want to do this. And it was like a year. I can't sit in a classroom. And I have to believe I'm not the only person out there who's like that, who's like the subject that I went back to school to study. I ended up studying on my own and surpassing everyone that I knew who had studied it in school.
So I wonder if that having that experience of like making real money at a young age changed your perspective or showed you more of a vista of possibilities than a lot of us had. You know, my job was I worked at a car dealership detailing cars when I was 16. My first job was actually working at an apple orchard making donuts in a closet with no windows. You know, so they were like, you know, $4.75 an hour for my first job, maybe $5.25 for my second job. And I don't think I had any other employment to speak of while I was in high school. So to me, I was so schooled that the only path forward, the only way to push the rest of the way out of this tube into a world where I was actually like worthy of success and employability was to go to college. And being so schooled, when I got to college, you know, I thought that was the key. So I really actually embraced it. And I was studying communications, right? So now this is the answer to that frustration that I had experienced all through, well, definitely becoming an adult in the, like the K through 12 experience. So like 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, where I just wanted to get something out and no one would let me. Now I'm in a communications program at a college. I can produce videos. I can write articles. I can, you know, learn about, you know, all of these different aspects of production. And we're doing the work, you know, the unfortunate. So I embraced that. The unfortunate thing was I was a freshman in college in 1995. I graduated in 2000. Everything they were teaching us, and this is another problem with, you know, college and the bubble of college, or like, you know, the protective bubble of college or protection from the real world, because they weren't putting us out into the real world to do this kind of work and actually see what it's like to be in these organizations. Like, what's it like to work for a radio station? What's it like to work for a television station? I remember, like, after I graduated, going into interviews at radio stations, they were the most disgusting places filled with the saddest people I had ever seen. I remember this guy who interviewed me. I was probably like 21, and it was for some entry-level job at a radio station. He had like a yellow short-sleeve dress shirt with like a brown tie, and I was just disgusted by his appearance, you know? And like, how was this guy interviewing me for a job? I would have liked to have known how sad these places were, you know, before I actually got, you know, spent, what, $60,000 to get a permission slip to go in there for an interview. But I didn't get that experience. What I did get was an opportunity to create things, but it was just, you know, bad luck for me. And I only blame myself for not, you know, having my fingers on the pulse or my ear to the street of a changing market. But there was a digital revolution happening when I was in college learning about how stuff was done in the 1970s, you know, in radio and television. So by the time I graduated in 2000, I was going out into a world where all of the information that I had just spent the last 4 years learning was completely irrelevant. So that was actually at that point that I started making the transition to education to satisfy that same need of like, I can learn stuff, I can learn how to do stuff, and then I can project that out to other people. And, you know, teaching ultimately satisfied that need for a fair amount of time. But I stuck with it for the whole 4 years because I saw that as like the only path to the opportunities that I wanted. But I see that as a result of going through definitely high school in such a state, like zombie is a great word. Use that word zombie, but it was a state of unconsciousness where I just felt like I have to have people just keep pushing me through this until the end. And then I guess the opportunities present themselves, but that it never worked out that way.
You're not interested in forcing your beliefs on anybody.
Of course.
Yeah. Somebody comes to you, and I'm sure this happens all the time. Say they come to you and their child is fifth grade,
mm-hmm.
and they say he just can't. He doesn't pay attention in class. He has no interest in class. We need to, you know, we want him to get an education. We want him to learn. What are the options, you know, besides, you know, I mean, within reason, I mean, I know how much a private school education goes for these days, especially the really good schools. And it's completely outrageous. I mean, I'm talking even primary, middle and high school. I know of one that's very close to me that is a, I mean, talking about $25,000 a year. For high school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so these people are, you know, they're normal income folks, middle income folks. What are some ideas that you give, that you would give them? So, you know, say their child's between 10 and 14.
Mm-hmm.
What are some ideas that you could bounce off them? If the child, say their child just can't pay attention in class, just has no interest whatsoever.
Well, I think the most important thing that has to happen first, that is a constructive foundation for building a solution, is that the investigation has to shift away from, oh, what's wrong with Brian? You know, why can't Brian focus? Why is Brian not doing well in school? Which is, this is what really kind of drove me, or was one of the really motivating forces to get me to where I am now, as far as my attitudes are concerned about school, was doing this work as a tutor, where I went in there as a report card policeman to say, Brian, why do you have a D? You know, what are you going to do with Ds? There's very good reasons why Brian has a D, right? It has to do with his interests. It has to do with his emotions. It has to do with the, you know, the context of his surroundings. Like, it's not just like, we frame this as school is great. School works for everybody. If it doesn't work for you, it's because you're defective. And no one will ever walk up to a 10-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old and say, you know, guess what, buddy? You're defective. But they will implicitly produce that feeling in a child. I did it. As an educator, even though it was framed as, hey, I'm just here to help, I'm on your side, we're going to fix this, the fact that I was there still pushes that idea, Brian, you're defective. I'm here because there's a problem with you. So I think, you know, the first piece of this conversation that we had, or the piece we just had, talking about the problems with school, oh man, we could get into the pedagogical problems with school, the environmental problems with school. I mean, we just barely touched on the history, that this is not an institution that was even set up to educate people. It was set up to house and standardize people to the needs of the rulers. So understanding that school is not this sacred, I think I used the word before, uncriticizable institution. There are a lot of problems here. This is not a system that's going to work for everybody. How could it? How could one system? And they will. If you go in there, they will talk about accommodations and modifications and personalization. But from my experience as an educator working in and around that system, it's nonsense, right? What the kid internalizes is, I am defective. And then, you know, the intervention begins, because school is the measure of your worth at that point. And what the adult authorities think of you is kind of a measure of your worth. Unfortunately, for a lot of these kids, it just produces a downward cycle. So the first step, the most important step, is saying, OK, this doesn't work for you. And that's not because there's a problem with you, because the whole environment and the intervention makes children feel that way. Mm-hmm. Nobody loves being there, which I think if somebody just loved being in that kind of place every day, that would be signs of another problem. But once things start to not go well, setting that idea up and making that very clear, especially on the parenting side of it, that's got to be the place to start. So you're equipping, even if you don't have the private school solution or the alternative education solution, at least, you know, you're putting them in a place where they know that whatever the problem is not a result of a personal defect.
Well, that's important today. Yeah. We see there are so many kids that are suffering. They throw drugs down their throat and they just, you can kick them out of school. And I mean, sometimes that could be the best thing for, sometimes that could be the best thing for them, but you know, most of the time, if you're getting kicked out of school, you're not getting what you just talked about. You think that there's something absolutely wrong with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the first, you know, we go to nursery school and they teach us this funny song about an old lady who accidentally swallowed a fly, right? So then she swallows a spider to catch the fly. And what does this crazy bitch do next? She swallows even bigger things to eat the things that she already ate, right? That's lunacy. But then if you look at the approach they actually take to intervention once these kids start having these problems with drugs, I mean, drugs especially, drugs are the best example of it. You know, I worked in this boarding school. A kid would be put on some drug to check some behavioral problem or to check some concentration problem. It would produce other symptoms. There'd be new drugs and they'd just be layered on and layered on and layered on. The interventions, you know, work in a similar way until this boy or this girl just feels, you know, so defective and so helpless and so like inappropriate to the task of doing anything important, intellectual or productive. People can get into some really dark places. And I worked with a lot of kids who were in those places as a result of these types of interventions. So I absolutely agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, I remember that when I was in school, especially 1 through 8, the report card, I think the middle school I went to did trimesters. So they broke the year up into threes. So we get three report cards. I remember my stomach hurting over it because I knew that most of the time, you know, there would be a couple grades on there that would be good, but most of it would be mediocre. And it really was like a sign of your worth. Mm-hmm. You were really judging yourself. You were bringing it home. And if you had the kind of dad I had, that was going to my first report card every year, every school year, hit 2 weeks before my birthday. I think the whole time I was in middle school, I never got a birthday present because I would get back from summer break and I was not interested in being there. So, you know, my first report card was always horrible grades. And then as the year went along, I would guess I'd kick it up a little bit because I had to, for no other reason than, you know, I had to, not that I wanted to, and not that I think the majority of kids in school want to. They just feel like they have to. And it really, I mean, when you think about it, that really, it almost seems like that's setting you up for the job, setting you up for the job that you're going to have when you get out, so that you, you're constantly examining yourself to see, you know, you're not making, it's not like you're doing it to make you happy. It's like you're doing it to make somebody else happy.
Right. Like self-examination driven by our own intrinsic desire to be better people. It's one of the most important things we can do. It doesn't relate at all to, you know, the feeling of being looked at under a magnifying glass constantly.
Right.
Right. And then there's like this bigger event where it's like, here comes the real magnifying glass and the spotlight and your parents are watching. And this is the thing that decides your worth. But who the hell do these people think they are to act like this is an acceptable frame to measure me in any way? None of this brings in any of my personal issues or personal interests or ambitions or, again, intrinsic motivation that's so important. This is just what you think of me based on what you make me do. What's educational about that?
Yeah. Once you get out of there, you can really look back and see how they act like jailers. You know, in jail, you have a job. You have to do this job. If you don't do the job right, you get punished. They're also looking at your how you act, your behavior, and they're judging you upon your behavior. And if your behavior is bad, you get sent here, you get sent to solitary confinement, detention, this, that. You know, I don't know that, you know, most teachers realize what they're doing to kids, but I'm sure some of them do. And that's pretty disturbing.
I think so. And I think that relates to one of the first things we talked about, like society's sacred institutions. Those things are much harder to look at. And teachers, there are examples of teachers who have done it. It's something that a lot of people in this profession struggle with at some point in their career, just from conversations that I've had with people who do this work. And many of them will try to at least, you know, meter it better and maybe correct it. Because, I mean, they are just following the cues of the system, right? And most people are not going to be John Taylor Gatto. Right. Most people are not going to go to that extent to rebel against what the system compels them to do. But yeah, I think teachers do realize this to a certain extent, but the support that they get inside the system, it creates very much as a way to deal with this, a kind of us versus them mentality. Right. Like mm-hmm. this job would be great if it wasn't for the kids. I've mm-hmm. heard teachers say that. Mm-hmm. And the other place to project blame is on parents. Right. And I think one of the things is like, hey, I can change a kid, you know, a 7 or 8 year old kid. I could grab him. I can send him to detention. I can tell him he's bad. I can give him demerits. I can take his stickers away, whatever, you know, like that's an easy thing to control when you're talking about, you know, changing this problem that everybody feels inside the institution. Like everybody knows this is a problem. So you just go to the easiest thing, right? The easiest thing is the kid. And then the next easiest thing to do, maybe it's even easier, is to sit in the teacher's lounge and go, these parents are so stupid. What are they doing at home? Why are their kids like this? Those are such attractive options compared to the hard work of actually saying, what about this institution that we have trapped ourselves in until we're in our 60s? Right. That's a really difficult confrontation for an educator to have. People are not doing it in public schools. Professors are certainly not doing this. Like they are very few professors, and we know the names of the ones who've gone in a different direction, but there are very few professors who are questioning, you know, the merits of college, you know, which is a very similar type of institution beset with a lot of the same problems. But that's the hard work. That's the real discomfort when you actually have to, you know, look at the institution that you are bound to, right? If you're a teacher, you went to a bunch of public school, then you went to some college, and then you went back into school. Right. So to look at the world beyond that, I mean, I remember doing it, and I have to think that a lot of other people in that profession have the same experience. It's like, what the hell else am I going to do? I have to make this work. So when it doesn't, I have to have, I mean, this was all realized for me in retrospect. I have to have stories about why it doesn't work. And then it was just a matter of, you know, being frustrated and being, you know, fairly iconoclastic and, you know, maybe not even really driven by the most healthy motivations. That at the right time, I said, you know what? It's this institution. And I need to, you know, change my role in it, change my place in it, or get out of it. But I didn't have a lot of the comforts that public school teachers have. You know, I was a 1099 employee. I was a contractor. So I didn't have, you know, benefits. I didn't have a pension. I didn't have summers off. I would commute 600 miles a week sometimes to do my job as a private service provider. Before that, I worked in a private school. So I had like minimal benefits and I was paid lower than public school teachers. So it was easier for me to kind of do an honest assessment of that whole system and say, yeah, there's got to be something better than this. But, you know, if you're one of these Wisconsin teachers in 2011 fighting Scott Walker and you're making $85,000 a year and you have a benefits package that's worth another $20,000 and you've already been doing that, you know, since you were 24 years old and you built a life around that. Like, I remember confronting around this time, there was a teachers rally in Concord, New Hampshire, and a bunch of us like massed together there, a bunch of liberty activists. We massed together to, you know, take on these teachers at this protest at the state capitol. And there was just this one poor woman, you know, maybe in her mid-30s, and we surrounded her. And we didn't do it on purpose. We were just so overzealous about having the confrontation that she walked out and she said, is this where the teacher's rally is? And we were like, you're a teacher? Well, let me tell you what. And we wound up, it became a show. It's episode 99 of my podcast, my confrontation with this poor woman who said something like, I heard they're going to take my benefits away. You know, I don't know what else I'm going to do. So, you know, the system kind of makes kids powerless in a way, but a lot of the people who populate that system, a lot of the professionals, I think, wind up feeling the same way. They become dependents, you know, and it sucks their, you know, their self-ownership and their enthusiasm, their self-efficacy out of that process as well, where they just, you know, they have to tie their identity to the institution and the institution has to survive.
Well, I think something that's also that also goes to this, and this definitely didn't happen when I was a kid, when I was in school. It's become so much more prevalent now. And I'm not talking about the inner city. I'm talking about suburbs and rich neighborhoods. Is once there is a little bit of a problem, even minor problems, nonviolent problems, they call the police. The police are constantly being called to schools now. The only time, I mean, I grew up in the inner city. I grew up in the Bronx. Like I said, I went to public school up until eighth grade, and there were police called. I mean, we might see police once or twice a year, you know, because there was a huge fight, or usually it was something that was happening outside of the school that spilled over into the school, you know, something in the neighborhood, you know, just your typical inner city, you know, bullshit. But it seems like now if a boy refers to, you know, flirts with a girl or draws a picture of a gun, these teachers are calling the police. Think about how authoritarian the mindset of a teacher is if their first impulse in doing something like that is to get the police involved.
Sure. Well, everything happens inside this authoritarian container, right? So when a problem presents itself, there's a very good chance that an authoritarian solution is ultimately going to be embraced. But the other part of that is just kind of like a mindlessness, an intellectual autopilot that people go on in that system for the reasons that I just described, right? Like, it takes self-ownership, self-efficacy, not just out of students, but out of teachers and even administrators as well, because, you know, everybody answers to somebody up the chain. And, you know, the zero tolerance thing that appeared now like 25 years ago, like, we were starting to see signs. I mean, I got snagged by zero tolerance when I was in high school. It was the first time I ever saw a cop in my school, not for fun and friendly reasons, right? They came in to arrest my friend because of a zero tolerance incident that happened off campus on a weekend. But they made an example of him. You know, five or six cops came into the cafeteria and took him out in front of everybody in handcuffs. And that was like a startling thing. Like, you could hear a pin drop in that room when that happened. It was really, really impactful, as it was meant to be. But, you know, zero tolerance is about having fixed solutions to complex problems that don't take personalities into account, that don't take circumstances into account, because those things require thinking, you know? Mm-hmm. So it is an autopilot solution that looks very authoritarian, but I think is also about a type of laziness. If you do this thing, this is what's going to happen to you. And that has just gotten worse and worse, because once you set up this idea that there's going to be zero tolerance policies in place, and zero tolerance problem policies don't solve the problem, well, what's the answer? It's not, you know, questioning the institution. It's not questioning the policies. It's just do more of it harder, you know? And that's been the trend in school, to the point where juvenile judges are complaining about school today. And they're saying, you know, this used to be the stuff that teachers would handle in the classroom, or that at the worst, a kid might have to go to the principal for. But like, people are being dragged in front of me all the time for basically what, you know, amounts to school discipline. You know, sometimes there's not even a law that's, or usually now, there's not even a law that's being broken. I mean, you think that's when the police would get involved. Like me and my friend, we were breaking the law. but you're right. Chicken fingers, you know, biting pieces off your chicken finger until it looks like a gun, that's not illegal. Anywhere. I don't think that's illegal in North Korea to do, you know?
They don't have chicken fingers there.
Oh, that's right. They don't have chicken fingers. But, you know, the North Korean equivalent of that.
I hear you.
So, yeah, it's very, very extreme. But it is, you know, just the almost logical progression of thoughtlessness in an authoritarian environment gets you to where we are today with cops in schools and zero tolerance.
That's excellent to talk about this, because and go on to my next subject and probably be our last subject. There is nothing I've seen that's more authoritarian right now when it comes to school than college campuses. And it's not coming from the faculty. Well, I mean, to a certain extent, the faculty will allow it, but yeah. I'm actually, the book I'm writing right now is all about this. It's,
nice.
And it clearly out, it'll be a primer on the cultural Marxism taking over the campus and spilling out into the world. So there are a lot of people who I think especially libertarians, anarchists, who have kids in high school right now, or they could be homeschooling, and they want their kids to have a higher education. Possibly the kid wants to have a higher education, but they don't want to be $120,000 in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be exposed to just this absolute madness that is taking. I mean, we have, you know, people would think that would have no place in Georgia. I mean, I'm talking about, like, I'm not even talking about, you know, maybe colleges around Atlanta, because, you know, Atlanta is pretty much like any other big city, you know,
sure.
A lot of liberalism. But I mean, like, University of North Georgia, which is in Lakewood by Gainesville, which is very, what, you know, what people would call redneck. And they're starting to have that problem. I was supposed to speak there at the Politically Incorrect Club, and the Politically Incorrect Club told me, don't come.
Oh, wow. Why?
So, because they were sponsoring it with another club, and the other club decided from my Twitter feed that I was anathema.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. So that I was too politically incorrect for the Politically Incorrect Club.
Understandable.
Yeah. Yep. And, right. You know, I have no problem with that. I will use that. I use that as much as I can. That I was, they wouldn't let me talk at this college at the Politically Incorrect Club. But I just saw recent articles out of that school about this cultural Marxism, this SJW culture presenting itself, which is just, you wouldn't think that we're talking about rural Georgia now. It's not even a suburb of Atlanta. So if people asked you your opinions on alternatives to college, I mean, obviously trade schools, all that's out there. What would you talk to people about?
A path to a career, right? Like, so if somebody was already in high school and they were on the college track, like,
yeah.
Let's find a path to a career that doesn't involve, you know, exposing your teen to that environment, and doesn't involve, you know, enormous amounts of debt. So one of the things that I've been most enthusiastic about promoting, and I've had a couple of guys on my show. And even though, you know, I love these guys, I love what they do, and I love the thing they've created. It's called Praxis. I think their website is Discover Praxis. If you just Google Discover Praxis, you can learn more about this. It's basically like a 6-month boot camp and then a 6-month apprenticeship. And you get paid to do the apprenticeship. The program costs money. You know, it might in some cases rival, like, I don't know, years tuition.
It's $11,000 right now.
Yeah, $11,000. So, I mean, I don't even know if you can still go to college for 6 months that cheap anywhere. You know, when I was a freshman in college, the most expensive semester in the country cost $11,000. You know, it was Bennington College. It was in the town where I went to college. It was the other school in that town. And I was like, wow, that's like $20,000 a year. That's insane. Yeah, so during that time, you're going to make more money working as basically a paid intern. And, you know, when you graduate from that program, the Praxis program, I think their average starting salary is like around $50,000. I would, as much as I like these guys, I would like to see more examples of operations like that pop up, you know, make college irrelevant. The guy he interviewed, Zach Slayback, said, you know, we're trying to, I've said this so many times in the last week, build a better credential than the college degree. I can't believe I almost forgot that, right?
That's a great phrase.
If you can build a better credential than the college degree, college is irrelevant, right? Right now, they've got that marker cornered. Thaddeus Russell, who's on my show all the time, former academic, has talked about the credentialing and the accreditation process and, you know, what a tangled web that is, that almost makes it impossible for alternative education institutions at that level, at the college level, to compete with college because it's such a cartel. But a career-focused institution or organization like Praxis is right now a workaround for that. So I'd like to see more things like that pop up. But a lot of the alternative schools that I visited on my School Sucks Across America tour, and a new one just popped up in New Hampshire, they're very much, as soon as kids start to feel like adults, like as soon as nature starts to tell you you're an adult, not your parents, not your teachers, not the law, you know, you're 13, you're 14 years old, and you want to start asserting yourself and, you know, doing something meaningful like I did when I was in high school, producing something, projecting something into the world, you need to have enough time and freedom to immerse yourself in the adult world. You know, so schools like Sudbury create opportunities like that. They link kids up and any sort of free school, alternative school, even a lot of Sudbury is like a democratic style school. It's very much about like, let's break this segregation by age. Let's break this idea that we put a bunch of 15-year-olds together and then we stick a 25-year-old who also doesn't know anything and has never done anything in the real world at the front of the room to be in charge of them all. Like, that's dumb. Let's get kids out there and connect them with people who are actually doing meaningful things. John Taylor Gatto was doing this in the early 90s, you know, in the late 80s. He was like, all right, you know, I'll team you up with, this friend of mine who I've vetted, and you go work at the newspaper for the day and see if you like that. You live in the adult world. That's how you become an adult. You know, I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I was talking with a couple home educating parents, and they said, we don't see it as raising children. We're raising adults. We're raising people into adults. School prepares people for compliance in a workplace. It prepares people for citizenship. It's great for that. They deliver on that promise to make people ready to be citizens. But none of that has to do with like success or personal satisfaction or life fulfillment. You know, that has to happen by letting those people go out and actually move and produce in the world as soon as they feel they're ready to do that, and connect them to people who are enthusiastic about helping them. And there's no shortage of those people, and there's no shortage of those opportunities, but school is a roadblock in that. Because not only do you have to be there 40 hours a week, but you also have to do maybe, you know, 20, 25, 30 hours of homework on top of that. And you have to do extracurriculars for your college application. And maybe, you know, and more, I'm sure schools have gotten a little bit better about this over the last 25, 30 years since I was trapped in there. Maybe there is a little more immersion, especially through like extracurricular activities in the regular world, in the adult world, in the productive world. But it still is, you know, nowhere near the list, top of the list of schools' priorities at this point. And that's a huge problem. And that's really setting young people back. And college is even more of a protective bubble. You know, I was talking to Peter Gray on my show last week. You've got to invest tens of thousands of dollars before they'll even give you a look at the real world, right? Through some kind of internship or apprenticeship. I mean, in a lot of these programs, you got to be a sophomore, a junior before that opportunity even becomes available to you. Kids should be having those opportunities like, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years earlier, as soon as they feel they're ready, they're enthusiastic, and they're capable of doing that.
Plug your website, plug anything you want right now. Do you have any appearances coming up?
No, no. I'm actually traveling for the rest of this month. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania right now. The website is schoolsucksproject.com. And Mance, I will make a introductory page for your audience. So if people go to schoolsucksproject.com, let's say beyond the wall.
Yeah, beyond the wall would be good.
All right. schoolsucksproject.com/beyond the wall. There'll be like an introductory page with our mission and some of our work. I'll put up the John Taylor Gatto video series that I did that goes through the whole history of the problem of, you know, public education and the problems with public education. It's about documentary length. It has 15 parts, but all the parts are short, so people can, you know, take it piece by piece. I'll put up some recent examples of alternative education that we've covered, that I covered on my tour, so they can get a sense of what we're all about. And I have a Twitter. It's at School Sucks Show. And people can also follow us on YouTube. The username is School Sucks Podcast.
It was great to have you on, Brett. I'd seen you on on a TV show or a video podcast. And I've heard you on Tom Woods. I heard you on Thaddeus Russell. And you just... When I hear you talk, it's just everything that you're saying about school, obviously, from what we just talked about. I mean, 100% I understood exactly what was going on because I was right there in school. I was one of those people that they were like, you know, I can tell that this guy's really, you know, got a head on his shoulders and can probably do a bunch of stuff, but he really doesn't want to be here and has no interest. And I really wish back when that was going on that there was there were voices like yours that I could have listened to make my path not as hard as it was.
I really appreciate you saying that. That's definitely something that was really important to me about School Sucks right from the beginning. Is what would I have really appreciated hearing somebody on the other side of the room say when I was in that position? And you know, I try to be that voice the best I can. And I do really think that this education versus schooling piece of the puzzle is really, really important for promoting the ideas of liberty. So I really appreciate you giving me a place on your rapidly expanding platform. I'm excited to see where this goes for you. But I really, really enjoyed the conversation, and I'd be happy to do it again anytime. This was awesome.
I look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.